This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I talked to my brother yesterday, and he has negative 21 degrees up there in northern Michigan. And this is the perfect place for all you snowbirds to just come down here and just enjoy our beautiful weather. Now, I'm really happy that we have in the studio today our legal eagle, Bill Larson. And then stay tuned for at the bottom of the hour, I have a really interesting guest, Rosemary Borrell, who's going to be talking about her book, Thriving in the Care of Many Mothers. She's a fascinating woman who's accomplished so much in her life, and so I'm real excited to talk to her. But meanwhile, hi, Bill.
How
are you?
Good morning. I'm fine.
Oh, it's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
I've been getting more and more questions from our listeners, and I just want to remind everyone, if you have a question for Bill, you can send it to me at patsy.radio@gmail.com or go to my website, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and there is a form there you can fill into and send me your questions. So, Bill, I've got a few questions coming up, and then I know that you recently spoke at one of our writers' events and got some more questions. So let's start with one that Elizabeth sent me, and she says, why aren't titles protected? She wants to know because she says that why can, you know, writers, so many books have the same title. Like there's a 100 books called Revenge.
That's true.
And you can't protect a title.
That's correct. Not for a single issue.
Not for a single issue.
Right. If it comes out in a series, you can protect it. For instance, Computers for Dummies, Dogs for Dummies, This for Dummies, That for Dummies. There's a title that can be protected because it comes out in a series. But if it's the title of a single work, it's not protectable under our laws.
Ah, so Sue Grafton with her A is for, and B is for this and that. That's protected?
Say that again?
Well, Sue Grafton has an alphabet. All of her books are something like A is for Alibi, B is for something, C is for like this down the list. Is that protected?
If it's in a series, if it's written in a series. It has to be more than a single edition.
Ah.
So, for instance, Gone with the Wind. I can write a book right now, Gone with the Wind, and use that title.
Ah.
Now, I can't copy the words inside the book, right? Those are copyrighted. Uh-huh. But if I come up with my own story, Gone with the Wind, I'm entitled to use that title.
So if, now Elizabeth tells me that she has a title that she must be very fond of it, and it's the title of the family in the book, like sort of the Ewings of Dallas or
right,
whatever. So how would she go about that? Would she have to be writing the series, or would she just, if it's a one-off?
Yep, if it's a one-off, then you can't protect it.
She can't.
Particularly surnames. So if you're using a proper name, a surname of somebody, somebody else can use it. Again, the difference is not necessarily the names, but the content of the work. The characters,
uh-huh,
the scenery, what they say, how they act, how they dress, all the other components that make up copyright.
Okay.
So you can't protect those surnames except in very limited ways. I give the example, Eric Clapton, okay? He's a very famous musician, right? We all know his name, so he can protect his name because that's what he uses to sell himself.
Uh-huh.
But if you're writing novels or you're writing books and you're just using surnames, it's typically not protectable.
So you have to come out with an original name if you want to stand out when they do the search. You know, if you write another book called Revenge, probably 20 other books will come up before yours.
And this is the same for trademarks. You can't trademark the name of a book. You can't copyright the name of a book.
Okay.
Not unless it's a series.
So, Elizabeth, I suggest you start writing a series, and then you can do something special with it. So another question that's come up, and this I think we discussed a little bit, but this is now more serious because a writer who has sort of put into his book characters from famous movies, primarily...
And not using typical surnames, using made-up words.
Well, yeah, but like he has a character who's a Vulcan. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that
comes from Star Trek.
Yeah, Star Trek. So
Gene Roddenberry.
Can he say that?
No.
He can't say that.
No, because that's the property of somebody else.
He can't say, I walked into a bar and there were five Vulcans there and I didn't like the look
of them. So the Star Trek series, right, which is a series, right? It's a series of shows. It's a series of, you know, each show is a book, you could say. So they own the Star Trek and they own the characters and they made those characters up. And when we think of Klingons and we think of Spock and we think of these things, we immediately conjure up Star Trek. And for that reason, they own the goodwill in those names, and so you can't use them.
You can't use them.
Not without permission.
Okay. Well, I don't think they would ever give him permission. And that's that's just the way it goes, right?
It's theirs. They created it. They own it. They copyrighted it. And you can't use it without permission.
So he better come up with some new and original characters.
That's right.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Some made-up words.
Okay. That's why my lovely guest a week ago, Katie Price, that's why she's so clever, because she came up with a whole bunch of new characters, and they're going to be hers, and nobody can use them.
Now she can develop them and protect them.
And that's what she's going to do, and thanks to you, she's going to be protected completely. I know. You know, that's always something, you know, writers go around and around. There's so many legal little things that they don't know, and so it is always, I always tell... writers, that it's worth the investment to have a lawyer. I can say that from experience of the time when I did not have a lawyer. But also, one of the questions that has come up, and this happened to me, so that's why I'm sort of familiar with it, when somebody came to me and they said, well, okay, if I have written a book, it's complete, and I want it to be critiqued by a professional, somebody who really has experience in critiquing books, perhaps a famous editor. Should they get a release, like not a release, get the person to sign something, a non-disclosure, that's
yes.
what I mean.
Yes, and the answer is yes.
Yes.
Right, so whenever you're contracting with anybody for anything, okay, that has to do with your work. So, for example, if they're editorializing, if they're creating artwork for, if they're assisting in character development or in the area of graphic arts or any of those things, whenever you're working with somebody to create something artistic or an authorship, you want to have it in writing. And one of the most important things that needs to be in that writing is that I'm paying you money and I'm getting back in return some artistic creation, which I own and not you. And the law says if it's not in writing, it's not enforceable. So if you and I had a handshake and then you helped me write the book, I couldn't come back later, even though I paid you a bunch of money, and say you don't own half of it, okay? Because your mere contribution creates the copyright as a matter of law. And without transferring that to me in writing, you retain ownership.
Okay, because that's one of the important things. Quite often a writer, you know, has a particular talent. You can write a book, or you can write a screenplay, and then actually writing the synopsis or the synopsis.
It's a group effort, yeah. So there's going to be others involved.
So, but it belongs to you as long as you...
As long as you have the magic words in writing. And in intellectual property law, the contracts are very specific, and we have what's called magic words. And the courts say, if those magic words are in the contract, then it's valid, and you can't argue it. You own the work. If you don't have it in writing, because intellectual property law requires it to be in writing, it's just a handshake, it's not enforceable, even though they pay you money. So it's got to be in writing, and it's got to have the magic words. And if those magic words are in there, then it's enforceable, it's done, you don't have to worry about it.
And when that now, let's say we hire somebody to write a synopsis or to write the critique. But what about somebody who is a producer or even a lawyer comes and says, oh, I really like that book. I would like to show it to somebody in Hollywood. And this has happened. It happened to me. And it has happened to people.
It will continue to happen.
And it happens all the time. So can you, I mean, will a lawyer sign the same thing?
Yes.
He'll sign it.
Yes.
If he's a legitimate lawyer.
Correct.
Or a legitimate producer.
And some of my clients ask me that. They say, well, I'm going to tell you my invention. I'm going to show you my work for the purposes of either critiquing or protecting it, right, because I file applications for patents and copyrights. And they often say, how do I know you won't steal it? Well, as a matter of law, lawyers can't do that because the laws of the state of Florida and all the states have provisions that lawyers can't steal their clients' ideas or patents. So lawyer, you don't need it in writing. But the default setting is always get it in writing and always make sure it has the magic words in there. Don't try to write it yourself. If you write it yourself, the magic words won't be in there. Later on, you'll try to enforce it and it'll be invalid or unenforceable.
Well, I do have another writer who actually has it not in writing. They videotaped the conversation with a producer. Well, a person who claimed to be a producer or may have been a producer or we don't know yet.
Wannabe producer?
Like her book. Mm-hmm. And they had a meeting, and she recorded the meeting. And in this meeting, he said, I'm going to take it to Hollywood, and I will show it to some of my friends. What happened?
There's a real question of whether that created a contract or whether there's any enforceable provisions of that. So the default setting is get it in writing, make sure a lawyer writes it so it has the magic words in there, then you'll always be protected.
Okay.
Now keep in mind, this is the way things fall out sometimes. Let's say you and I have a conversation, and later on, you go on to have this great book, and you're making all kinds of money, and the movie rights are coming, now the money's pouring in, right? And then I say, well, what about me? I was back then early on, remember that conversation we had? And you said that I was getting 10%, or I could make anything up. And if you didn't have anything in writing, it would be very difficult for you to defend against that, right? I could say that I made a contribution. And this is the way it usually falls out. That's why if you have it in writing and there's magic words in there, if I come back later, you show the judge this piece of paper and say, Judge, I own all the copyright. He signed it away way back when. He got paid. He doesn't own it. Case closed.
Okay. So it's...
Get it in writing.
I'll always get it in writing.
That's the magic words.
That's the best thing always. Now, another question that, of course, I think you had this when you recently spoke to the... Bay Area Professional Writers Guild. And this is a question that I've also been asked. How do you protect your copyrights or to pass them on to your family?
To your heirs, right.
Or to your heirs, yeah.
And so this is a topic that comes up often, and it was a topic that we discussed last week. And so because copyrights outlast the authors because they live longer than the authors.
And how long do copyrights?
100 years.
100 years.
Okay, so the copyright's going to outlive the author. So let's say the author dies, all right, and the copyright still has another 20, 30, 50 years of protection of royalties coming in potentially. How do we pass those on to our children, our loved ones, our church, whoever we want to devise those rights to? And it can be done one of two ways. A, you can have a will, right, which is a written instrument under state law that says I give these assets away, and copyrights can be one of those. The better way to do it is through a trust. A trust is another type of legal document that's used to dispose of assets when somebody dies, okay? And so if you have a popular work and it's valuable financially and there's money coming in and you want to protect it and make sure that when you pass on the right people get it and that it's not pilfered or taken advantage of, put that asset, the copyright itself and the incoming royalties into a trust, and then your heirs will be safe and you'll be happy that your work will go on the way you want it to after you pass on.
Okay, now one question that someone asked me, they wrote an inspirational book about the religion, and they have put it onto Amazon as a self-published book, and they're having the royalties that are collected paid directly to their church.
You can do that.
And that will be forever, even after they die? They don't have to...
Well, the problem is that let's say they pass on and they don't have a will.
Yeah.
Okay. Automatically, if there's nothing in writing that shows that the church gets those royalties, right? Because even the church is required to have a written agreement. Churches are not exempt to written agreements. Then the heirs could come back and say, well, we don't want the money to go to the church. We want the money from that. And there's nothing in writing. So we're taking it. And so you can devise things to the church, and it needs to be in a written piece of paper, like a trust or a will.
Okay, because I thought that might be a problem.
A lot of clients that do that, that leave their assets when they pass on to their church, and then they spread some out from the kids, or maybe they have a housekeeper that they liked, or even people give it to their pets.
Okay, but so it's not like if you have five books and you want to give the royalties from five books to five different grandchildren.
You have to clearly state that in your will or your trust.
So it still has to be in the will. It's not that it's just Amazon's just going to keep paying that money.
No, because things will change once you pass away.
And Amazon finds out you're dead.
Well, usually what happens is Amazon doesn't find out what's going on. They're just sending the checks.
Yeah, they're sending the checks.
Somebody else steps in and says, I'm taking the checks.
Uh-huh.
And then directs Amazon to send them the checks. And Amazon says, well, I don't know you. Who are you? Why am I sending you the checks? And then they bring a court action to force Amazon to send them the money.
Okay, so it is a little bit of a complicated procedure because I do know another
husband. So when you die, all of your assets go to your heirs, right? The people, first your children, and then to whoever may be.
Right. Especially if it's like 100 years, right? You know,
and so if you want it to go to somebody that's not in your family and you don't put it in writing, they could lose out when you pass away.
Okay, so that's something really people have to think about and keep a record of who you're sending your Amazon,
where the royalties are going. And where you want it to go if you die.
Yeah. Okay, so that's something I think.
Wills and trusts, we call them.
Wills and trusts.
Wills and trusts.
And that's something you can help people with, right?
It's not something that I do. It's something that I know of because I help. But you need to hire an attorney who specializes in wills and trusts and estates. They call it wills, trusts, and estates. Lots of great attorneys here in this area. Particularly because we have an aging population that do this kind of work. It's not terribly expensive. It's not cheap, but it's not terribly expensive.
Okay, so that's a good idea to do. Now, talking about fees, there are standard fees that you charge and that all lawyers
charge. There are typical fees. I wouldn't say standard, okay? If you have somebody who is incredibly wealthy and they have a lot of properties and businesses and copyrights and patents and all that, that could be a very expensive and difficult trust and will to set up. But if you have somebody who has less assets, and maybe they just have that one asset is the copyright royalties or the patent royalties that are coming in, that would be much easier to accomplish and a lot less expensive. So it depends on the facts and the person involved.
Okay, now talking about fees, now I know that you are, you very nicely help people, will walk them through the copyright procedure because it is confusing, especially to someone, who...
it's fraught with trapdoors, and if you do it wrong, you don't find out till later.
Exactly.
When there's a problem, then the problem's a problem.
Exactly. So, and you do give a free consultation to people.
Yeah, so I help authors. Typically, a lot of my authors I help, they are in the early parts of their career. They don't have a terrible amount of money. I like to see them be successful, and so... we like to help those folks, and we do.
Okay, that's very important. So I just recommend to all of you writers out there, visit Bill, and he will walk you through things. That way you have somebody ready to turn to because as we have a few writers in our area who are coming up who have gotten to that phase where they've gone beyond the query letter, and they are already talking to literary agents. And then sometimes things move very quickly after that. And I highly recommend, you cannot just, how can I say, agents are wonderful. You can't do it yourself, and agents are great. But in the end, agents are working for themselves. And there's always this need to have the lawyer who is protecting your interests 100%.
That's correct.
Because agents can have other factors involved in what they're doing. So
many times it's not that anybody's evil or anything like that. It's just that people have misperceptions about what the other person's thinking, or they remember it differently later on. And that's just the nature of the human, all right?
Yeah.
That's the nature of our beast. Okay? And so the purpose of having it in writing is that later on when we forget what we were talking about way back when, we've got this piece of paper we can said, and we can reread it and say, oh, yeah, that's what we agreed to. Now I remember it's right there in writing. But if you don't have it in writing, it's always going to be.
Well, like this woman who met a producer who is taking her stuff, her work to Hollywood. She thinks, and I'm not sure, you know, first of all, I don't know, is it legal to tape somebody without them knowing it?
She did not tell them
that she was taping them.
You can't do that. You can't video or record conversations of somebody without telling them they're being recorded. Once you've told them they're being recorded, if they continue with the conversation, you're okay. But you can't secretly record people.
Yes, she did secretly.
And that's not permitted. There's state laws that prohibit that.
Ah, okay.
So, you know, we don't want to do that.
So, yeah, okay.
So that's not evidence, okay?
So right
now you can't
there,
go into court.
Not, she can't go no,
you can't
into
take it to court and say, Judge, look at this. It's not admissible evidence because it was incorrectly gathered.
Okay. Well, she thought in some states you could do it, and she thought Florida was a state.
Laws are different in different states. That's true. But the default setting is get it in writing, see a copyright lawyer. We have a way that we do things that's time-tested, okay? What I do, I didn't make up, okay? I learned from the old guys, okay, uh-huh. who've been doing it for 100 years. And through that time, we have found a way, the right way to do it. And the right way is the only way to do it. And so I'm not an artist, okay? I'm more of a robot. I do the same thing every time because I know exactly that this protocol is correct. The artist does something different every time, right, because they're being creative. And my job is not to be creative. My job is to be the robot that does it for you the same way, the right way, every time.
Every time.
And then it's correct.
Okay. And as a matter of fact, when you're working when you get to the point where you're working with a writer on a contract with like an agent.
Yeah. 90% of it is standardized, what we call boilerplate. There's just very few terms and conditions in any of these contracts that are drastically different, okay? It's usually very minor things. And so because the contracts are kind of typical and accepted in the law, we stick to this standardized format, and everybody knows what everybody's talking about.
But it is important to cover all the bases because you don't know what the future may bring in the form of entertainment, in the form of what the written word can be taken today.
And we know that, right. And we know that from experience. We have a crystal ball. It's not, you know, it's a little foggy, but still we can see into it. So we can foreshadow what's going to happen to you potentially in your career. And we put that into your contract. You don't need to really even think about it right now or even know it's in there. You know, trust a good lawyer that he's going to put that in there. So if, let's say, that they come back after the book's released and say, oh, my God, we want a movie. All right. I've already got it in your contract. All right. If it goes to a movie, it's already spelled out what you get. You keep the copyright. You have artistic.
Or they want a game or a spinoff or whatever the next form of entertainment's going to be. You don't know.
That's all in there. So you don't have to think about it. It's all pre-done for you to protect you so that when that time comes, your rights have not been lost. They've been preserved.
Okay. Well, you are a member of what? What is the Organization for Intellectual Property Lawyers?
American Intellectual Property Association.
And
that's the biggest worldwide,
and that's what you should look for when you are looking for an intellectual property lawyer. And we have our legal eagle right here. What is your telephone number?
Here in Pinellas County, Florida, it's 727-546-0660, or find us on the internet at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Okay, well, that's good advice. And I want everyone to really, really, really think about this because a lawyer can make your life very nice.
And what's our takeaway for today? Get it in writing.
Get it in writing. Always get it in writing. Okay. Well, Bill, thank you so much for coming in and for answering the listeners' questions. And I'm sure I'll have some more next month.
Keep the questions coming in.
And meanwhile,
great questions.
Merry Christmas. Have a wonderful, wonderful Christmas and a Happy New Year. And everybody, I'm just telling everyone, go and get some chocolate wine from the Miami Avenue Wine Bar in Indian Rocks Beach. And I'll be right back with my next guest. Thanks.
is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Looking for a good book? Then get over to Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. Check out the latest books from local authors like Angela Hunt, who wrote the book for the film Risen, or Bonsu Brenvick, whose books preserve the memories of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel. What do you enjoy reading? A thriller? A romance? How about a mystery or a sci-fi? At the Book Nook, you'll find it all. Remember, one of the joys of life is to read. Located in Indian Rocks Beach, look for the blue building with the mermaid on the side, on the corner of Miami Avenue and 2nd Street, two blocks south of the post office. Open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 4. And don't forget, while you're there, check out Miami Avenue's great collection of Florida wines, local art, and fantastic gifts. Miami Avenue Book Nook, where you will be inspired to read.
Are you a writer? Do you have a great idea for a movie? Want to know how to get started? Then join the Actors, Screenwriters, and Crew Production Group. They meet every month in Clearwater to talk about how to construct a winning script. Get your script read by the group or just join in the fun. Contact Barbara Harrington, the best-selling author of Give Him Back to God, for time and location. She brings her experience as a screenwriter and casting director in such hit films as Cocoon and Absence of Malice to this lively group of film enthusiasts. So call Barbara, 727-572-6345, or email her at bharrington2@tampabay.rr.com. Get inspired, and one day you may hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. Call Barbara for details at 727-572-6345.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Passive with a Z, and I'm back with my next guest, Rosemary Borrell, the author of Thriving in the Care of Many Mothers. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi, Patsy.
Oh, it's so nice to have you in here today. I was really thrilled when I got your book, which is available at the Miami Avenue Book Nook, and I was so impressed with the writing and with your story. You are quite an amazing woman. Book is a very heartwarming story about your life. Of course, you were born in Jamaica, and you have accomplished so much from Jamaica. Rosemary went on to be the first Jamaican woman accepted to England's prestigious and wonderful Leeds University. And later on, you had the position of a Jamaican mission to the United Nations. Right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
And you got a Carnegie Fellowship. So this is a story that really is inspiring. It's from being poor to working her way up in life with such a wonderful spirit that I was thrilled to read the book. I really
Thank
was.
Thank you. Thank
so, let's yeah. talk a little bit about the story of what your life was like. You have one of the wonderful things about autobiography and memoirs is that it preserves these stories of a time and a place that would be forgotten if somebody didn't actually take the time and energy and effort to write it down. And you've done that. Let's start with your birth. You were born in Jamaica. And how did it come about that you have you were in the care of many mothers?
Okay. Yes, I was born in Jamaica in the 1940s because my story spans the period 1940s to the 1980s. But my mother was a single mother. And because of her job, because she worked in a hotel where she had to live in, she started off in catering, and then she moved on to the front desk, and eventually she became the manager. But she had to live in, so she could not, she needed help in order to take care of me. So she had to depend on family and friends to help raise me. And chief of these was my uncle and his wife, and they provided the home and the stability which every child needs. But I also boarded with other families, and I had other mothers in order to go to school. So it took like the whole village to raise this child.
It really was a whole village to raise this child. And of course, some of the experiences were better than others. Some of the people in your life were really, really good to you.
And I would say generally they were. When I stayed in private homes, friends of my mother, they really nurtured me, and they cared for me. Many of them cared for me like their own children. So. And I considered myself fortunate looking back now, because through that I was able to get an education, which was what really was able to have me be a success later on in life.
And your mother's name was?
Frances Anderson.
Frances Anderson. Mm-hmm. And she was determined to get you a good education.
That was important.
That your life would be different from hers. She had a difficult life, and it must have been so hard for her to have to be separated from you in order to make a living. But she did this for you so that she could ensure that you would get a good education.
Oh, yes, that was important. And one thing I have to say about Jamaica in those days, secondary education was neither universal nor free. So if you could not afford to pay for it, then you had to try to get a scholarship. And I was fortunate. One of my mothers was a teacher. Now, the teaching families, they had the advantage because there were only a few scholarships available. For example, in Jamaica, there are 14 parishes, and each parish was granted 2 scholarships per year. So that meant 28 scholarships for the whole island of Jamaica. Teachers' families had the advantage because they got extra coaching at home. And that was one of the advantages that was afforded to me.
Well, of course, many people might not know that Jamaica, of course, was once a colony of Great Britain.
Right.
And as such, there did have some openings for you to get an education in England. And how did this... You know, there in Jamaica, you lived a simple life, a hardworking life.
Right.
All of your family, they were all people who worked and who really strived to make their lives better for themselves and for their children. And how did it come about that you got a scholarship to go to England? Must have been pretty amazing. How old were you then?
I was 20 when I went to England. But I didn't have a scholarship. It was my mother and stepfather, who by then were in America, who actually made the sacrifice to put me through college in England.
So you didn't get any scholarship?
To England, no.
Wow.
No,
you got accepted.
They made that sacrifice for me.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
But you got accepted to Leeds.
I got accepted to Leeds.
But that must have been quite a change for you to be in Jamaica, so beautiful and warm, and then What was it like when you first arrived in England?
Oh, that was a culture shock. It was a culture shock because I arrived there. I didn't know a soul in England. I had no family, no friends. And I arrived in Leeds, and it was what? October? So it started to get cold.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Quite different weather.
Yes. And I was too late to get into a hall of residence. So I stayed with a landlady. They call it Diggs. And it was a culture shock because there I was told that I could only get a bath, like, it ended up being like once in 10 days because, you know, it's just the fire. They had to heat the water, you know, from the fire. And there were like 10 different people in the household.
Yeah,
so I had to wait that long to get a bath.
Was it in those days that where you had to put coins in the heater?
Some places. In that case, they were heating the hot water from the fire, the coal fire. Uh-huh. And that really shocked me. Yeah.
So now when you got to England, your course of study was what?
I did combined studies, a Bachelor of Arts in Geography and History.
And what was the college life for you like?
Well, that was quite an experience for me. I remember when I first went there, when I was doing orientation, they said, look to the right and look to the left. One of you will not be here by the end of the first term. And I thought, my parents were making such a sacrifice for me. I had to really do my part and perform. But it was really, I mean, part of the reason why they took me, they wanted overseas students from different countries. So you had an international student body. So that was quite a big experience for me.
So we skipped over a little bit about your mother got married.
Yes, she got married.
And moved to Tampa.
Yeah, they were in first of all, they were in Connecticut and New York.
And then eventually
they moved on when they retired, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and they paid for your education.
They
which
did.
Is wonderful.
Yes. I mean, looking back, no, I always knew it was a sacrifice. But when you're actually writing your memoir, you realize just how much of a sacrifice it was. Because I myself, I'm a parent and a grandparent. So now you really appreciate what they did.
Well, that's one of the wonderful things about writing your memoir, your autobiography, is that you get to go back and look at your life and the life of your family and to realize, and in your case, you didn't come from a rich family and you had a lot of hardships, but everyone in your family did their best. They really tried to help each other. They worked together, whether it was, doing your hair. I love the story of doing your hair. I think your hair is so beautiful, but apparently this was a big problem for you as a child.
Oh, yes. There was that incident of my hair when I went to Leeds again because it didn't have any black hairdressers. In Leeds at the time. Yeah, they didn't.
So
one of my friends who was a former schoolmate of mine, I found her in Leeds. And she was very talented. So she did my hair for me and other West Indian friends. So that I was lucky. I really was lucky.
Well, I love the enthusiasm that you write about these events. And you know, of course, it was at Leeds that you met your first husband?
Yes.
And what was he doing there? Where was he from?
He was from Trinidad, and he had he was lucky. He got a scholarship. So he did a Bachelor of Commerce degree. And in fact, I have this story of in my first year, I did economics, which I was not very good at. But he used to coach me in that. I was able to pass that exam, yeah.
And then eventually you got married and went to
A long time.
And you went to
Trinidad.
To live in Trinidad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And was that similar to Jamaica life there? Or?
Yes, in some ways, but then there are differences. Trinidad is a good distance, about, 900, 1,000 miles away from Jamaica. It's in the southern Caribbean, near to Venezuela. And they have more of a Spanish tradition. They've got people, Spanish and French origin, as well as East Indian. So it's much more cosmopolitan than Jamaica is, yeah.
And what is this event that you write about called Mass?
Mass?
Mass.
Oh,
masquerade.
It is Carnival.
Carnival.
You know, Brazil has its carnival in Rio.
And there
Trinidad has its own carnival.
Uh-huh.
Yes, every year. This is just before Ash Wednesday. So people, you know, we have different bands. They dress up in bands and they parade on the streets accompanied by music, either by the steel band or by brass bands on trucks. And I mean, that is so much fun. But carnival is just so diverse, so many different things, because they've got the steel bands on the first day of carnival, known as Juve. The steel bands go on the streets, they roll out, and they play early in the morning, and they have followers. We follow them all over town. And that is so wonderful. They have other things too. They have the Kiddies Carnival. They have the Calypsonians. There are so many aspects of carnival. They have the fetes, these big dances, you know, these fetes, where people really enjoy themselves. Some people don't sleep.
What you're hearing in Rosemary's voice is exactly what you get in her book. This joyfulness that she found in simple pleasures. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just so wonderful that she's preserved all of this in her book.
I also want to add that in Trinidad, one of my mothers was my mother-in-law too, my husband's mother. And she accepted me and welcomed me into the family. And she treated me just like her own daughters.
So I got the feeling as I'm reading the book that you enjoyed being able to tell these stories and to share these stories.
Oh, definitely.
And how did you, so you started writing and you had not written a book before. So,
no, this is my first book.
Your first book. And eventually you worked with an editor?
Yes, I did. I didn't set out to write a book. It was my son who asked me, because he wanted to know about the Jamaican side of the family. They were brought up in Trinidad, so they knew their Trinidadian side. But he wanted to know, and he wanted his children to know about, you know, where we came from. So I started writing, and there were some hiccups. It took me a long time in the end, but eventually I found this lady, Paula Stahel, who was doing classes at the Life Enrichment Center in Tampa. And that was one of the best decisions I ever made, to take classes from her, because she was the one who really got me going writing. It took me a long time in the end, nearly 9 years by the time I finished writing this book. But then she later became my editor, and she was very, very helpful. She was excellent.
Well, it is edited very well. I could tell from the flow, because so often, and this is something that I want to tell all of my listeners, if you're going to work on your story, and all of you, I'm sure, have wonderful family stories that you can put together, it is always best, once you've started the process, to eventually work with an editor to help you, because an editor has that eye and that ability to say, okay, we have to move a paragraph here, we have to add a little bit more here, just to keep that flow going. And that's what I like about your book, that it's just a fun and easy read. And even all on the difficult places where you talk about very personal things, it's handled so well. And as I said, what I like most about it is the absolute wonderful spirit that you have. You accomplish so much, and it's an amazing story and of perseverance, because so many people, they have disadvantaged lives. They might have only one parent. They might, and in your case, of course, it must have been heartbreaking for your mother to have to be separated from you for so often, and you know, always having to work in order to keep going and to keep to make sure that you had a good education. But your spirit kept you going, and that's wonderful.
I think that was something that is handed down by, you know, by my mother and my parents and my aunt. You know, they I think it's part of our tradition in Jamaica, I guess, because of the British influence, stiff upper lip type of thing.
Well,
you just keep on
going.
I never thought anything of it. I didn't think that I was disadvantaged or poor. I never knew anything different.
Well, see, that's the beauty of it. Mm-hmm. I also came from a very poor family, but I always felt we had everything. So it's the spirit and the determination that makes all the difference in life. And I think you've done a wonderful job with this. It's called Thriving in the Care of Many Mothers. It's by Rosemary Borrell. It's available on Amazon and also at the Miami Avenue Book Nook. And we're going to have some events coming up at Miami Avenue. And I'm hoping that Rosemary will come there and talk. And I will invite all my listeners to come in and meet her. And just to learn more about the process that she went through. And what I love also is the very beautiful, happy ending, because Rosemary became a widow at a very young age. Your first husband.
Yeah, I was 38. He was 39 when he died.
And his first name was?
Ainsley.
Ainsley Borrell. Mm. And he passed away. And, of course, it was very, very hard for you. But somebody wonderful came into your life, and he's sitting here actually in the studio, and he is so handsome, so beautiful. And this, of course, is your husband,
my
Charles.
My husband, Charles Hull.
And he came into your life. You knew him earlier when you were younger, and then suddenly he comes back into your life. And
yes, indeed. He also was widowed. And eventually we got together.
It's beautiful. It's a lovely.
I consider myself very fortunate.
Yes, well, I think he considers himself very fortunate. And he is absolutely delightful. And I'm hoping that Charles is writing some poetry. He's going to come back and be on the program and read his poetry. So I want to thank you, Rosemary, for coming in today.
Ooh, thank you for
Charles
having
for
me.
Sitting there and just smiling. He's so happy to see Rosemary. So I'm just really thrilled that you came in today, because I want to encourage everyone to write. And one of the things that is coming up here in our area is Angela Hunt is going to be having a workshop. Now, Angela Hunt is a fantastic author. She's published over 100 books, and one of her books is the novelization of Risen, the very big hit movie. And so you know she's a great writer, because they never ask you to do a novelization, especially for a movie such as Risen, which is a big hit, unless you're really good. And so Angela's a great writer, and she has a fantastic number of books out there. I know she's done over 100 books, but I love her sort of beautiful women of the Bible. She's done Esther, which is a lovely, lovely book. And the other ones are Delilah, Bathsheba. So she has a whole array of fantastic books that she's written. And her seminar is for authors or those people who want to be authors, And she has a two-day course that's designed to help you publish. And whether it's a novel or a nonfiction book, if you take her seminar, you will learn some of the tricks and some of the talents and things that you need to know in order to become a published author. And Angela is very clever. She's very charming, and her course is done with humor and clear instructions, and she'll guide you through that sort of the big picture. She'll help you plot a skeleton for your book, and she'll describe the process necessary to get your book ready for traditional publishing. If you want to go and go on to that next level of doing a query letter and finding an agent, or if you decide to self-publish. So Angela will help you through all of that. All participants will receive a detailed workbook and a copy of her comprehensive book writing lessons from the front. And really, this course is ideal for anyone. And if you sign up for the course, it's $149 now. After January 1st, it's going to be $199. The seminar or workshop is February 11th and 12th. It's from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For 2 days at the Holiday Inn and Suites in Harborside. For anyone who wants to spend the night there, you can do so. And the first 5 people to sign up at the Harborside, make reservations there, will be upgraded to a suite, which is really nice. It's a suite to have a suite. And so I would highly recommend that you go to AngelaHuntBooks.com and check it out. She has the details there and a sign-up form that you can use to sign up for her workshop. And I think it's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for you to learn from somebody who knows the business. She can take your book idea and really help you come out with a fascinating and interesting book, like Rosemary did with her book. So I want, again, to recommend to everybody that they come and join Angela Hunt in February and buy your package now at $149. It's a real bargain. You'll get all sorts of freebies, books, and all sorts of little extras that come with the sign-up. So it's a wonderful opportunity to just learn from an expert, and Angela Hunt is the best. Now, I just want to remind everyone that several other things are coming up. At the end of the month, I'm going to have another marathon of relay of 5 authors coming in on December 29th, and we're going to have 5 local authors all coming in one after another, and they're all been published through Eli Gonzalez, and he's going to join us, and we will talk about his program in January that he's going to be having at Barnes Noble in Clearwater. So meanwhile, I just want to thank everyone for joining me today. Remember, go out and get Rosemary's book. And remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. So take some time to write and look at Angela Hunt's website. So this is Patsy with Z, hoping that I will have you back here on Thursday, because I'm going to have a really exciting guest talking about Tom Clancy's newest book, even though he's not with us anymore. But it's a fun read. Bye now.